KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It's hard to proceed with a lot of the things we're doing because a lot of funds are still frozen. So it's kind of, we're in limbo right now.
Since President Trump returned to the White House, federal workers have lost jobs and some agencies have been effectively dismantled.
It's Wednesday, May 14th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, Trump announced this week that he would lift U.S. sanctions on Syria.
We speak with the head of the Syrian Emergency Task Force.
Also, Ocean Vuong's new novel, The Emperor of Gladness, is based partly on his experience working at fast food restaurants.
It made a big impact on me as a person to know that human relationships will always outpace ideological polemics.
Plus, clues on Reddit lead people on a treasure hunt in San Francisco.
It's validating to be like, I know San Francisco well enough that we are able to find this first spot we checked.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Russia has announced its delegation to talks in Turkey on ending the war in Ukraine, and Vladimir Putin is not on the list. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the Trump administration had been hoping to facilitate high-level talks.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is already in Turkey for a NATO meeting in Antalya and is planning to travel Thursday to Istanbul, where there had been hopes for a high-level meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian leaders. But President Putin is avoiding a face-to-face meeting with Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky, sending instead a low-level delegation headed by a former culture minister named Vladimir Medinsky. The ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Jeanne Shaheen, had predicted Putin would be a no-show and says it's time for the U.S. to put more pressure on him to end Russia's aggression in Ukraine. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge is temporarily blocking the Justice Department's cancellation of certain grants to the American Bar Association. The ABA has argued the department's action amounted to unlawful retaliation for criticizing the administration. More from NPR's Ryan Lucas.
The American Bar Association filed the lawsuit in April after the Justice Department canceled a series of grants with the ABA that funded services to victims of domestic and sexual violence. The grant termination came after the ABA publicly criticized the Trump administration over various actions. In its lawsuit, the ABA alleges that DOJ's canceling of the grants amounts to unlawful retaliation against it for exercising its First Amendment rights. Now, U.S. District Judge Christopher Cooper has granted the ABA's request for a preliminary injunction to stop the government from canceling the grants as the lawsuit moves forward. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump's plans to replace Air Force One with a luxury Boeing 747 jet from Qatar is drawing pushback from Republican lawmakers on Capitol Hill. More from NPR's Elena Moore.
Missouri Senator Josh Hawley said the move shows Qatar wants to build a closer relationship to the U.S., but gifting Trump a jumbo jet.
I prefer a big, beautiful plane built in the United States, made in America, bought in America.
He says if Qatar wants to help the U.S., they could reevaluate their ties to multiple groups in the region that the U.S. is critical of. Notably, the country has a long relationship with Hamas. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul also cast doubt on the plan, telling Fox News on Monday that he wonders whether the U.S.'s ability to judge Qatar's human rights record would be, quote, clouded by this gift. Elena Moore, NPR News, the Capitol.
The EPA says it's rolling back some of its limits on several types of water dubbed forever chemicals in drinking water. Wherever the agency says for two of the most common varieties, PFAS and PFOS, limits will remain in place. Environmental groups accuse the administration of abandoning common sense water rules. The Dow is down 89 points today. This is NPR. For the first time in more than three decades, federal health officials are reviewing the nutritional content of infant formula. NPR's Maria Godoy reports the FDA and other agencies say they want to ensure the safety of baby formulas.
The FDA is seeking public input to help determine whether existing nutrient requirements for infant formula should be revised or expanded based on the latest scientific data. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than half of all babies receive formula at some point in their first 3 months of life. A recent study found many formulas contained high amounts of added sugar, and an investigation from Consumer Reports found some formulas contain concerning levels of arsenic and lead. The FDA says it will also increase testing for contaminants in formula as part of Operation Stork Speed. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Federal judge in Virginia has released Georgetown researcher Badr Khan Suri from immigration detention in Texas, allowing the Indian postdoctoral fellow at Georgetown University to return to Virginia while his challenge to his detention continues. Suri was held in Texas for 8 weeks following his arrest in Virginia in March. The Department of Homeland Security accused Suri of actively spreading Hamas propaganda and promoting anti-Semitism on social media. Revoked his visa, though he's not been charged. Suri has denied the allegations against him. Crude oil futures prices eased a bit today after new government numbers showing inventories rising at an unexpected rate last week. Oil fell 52 cents a barrel to settle at $63.15 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. There are so many individual stories about federal workers losing their jobs around the country that the big picture can sometimes look blurry. Here at NPR, a team of reporters has been looking at agencies from food inspectors to nuclear scientists to firefighters and more. So to put some of these different puzzle pieces together, we've invited three of our correspondents who've been covering the initiative known as DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. Kirk Sigler was out in New Mexico talking to Forest Service workers. Andrea Hsu has talked to people at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Jeff Brumfiel has been reporting on government scientists and technical experts, including people responsible for nuclear weapons. Good to have you all here.
Hi, Ari.
Good to be here.
Hey, Ari.
So to help us understand the big picture, will you each start by sharing a specific anecdote that you think captures the overall narrative of the last few months? Jeff, you want to go first?
Sure. So in the early days of all this, I was speaking to people at the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is a sub-department of the Department of Energy. They're the civilian agency that maintains and stores all the nuclear weapons when they're not on bombers and submarines and things. And they told me managers were given just 200 characters, not words, characters to justify why employees at the agency should not be fired. And these people have very technically complex jobs that are essential to national security.
Like, a tweet used to be 140 characters. The bosses had 200 characters, just a little more than what a tweet used to be, to explain why somebody handling nuclear weapons should keep their job.
Exactly, exactly. And they just felt it was an impossible task.
Kirk, Andrea?
Yeah, Ari, I've been talking to people at the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. These are the people who make sure invasive pests and diseases, plants don't enter the country, and making sure, you know, food, mangoes, produce coming into the country into supermarkets is free of disease. So this agency has seen about 1,300 some people since January take this deferred resignation program, or the fork in the road. This was the offer to, you know, resign your job and, you know, get your pay and benefits through September. But, you know, you're basically being paid not to work, to leave the government. And now we're learning that the USDA is trying to rehire people to do some of these jobs. The Agriculture Secretary, Brooke Rollins, was asked about this on the Hill last week. Here's an exchange that she had with Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington.
We are actively looking and recruiting to fill those positions that are integral to the efforts and the key frontlines.
So you let people go and you're looking for new people to fill the positions that they had experience in?
We're having those discussions right now. We're working with all of you.
And, you know, that's a question that a lot of these workers who took the deferred resignation offer are asking, too. I mean, including many of them who didn't want to leave their jobs. They felt forced to leave because they were being bombarded with these messages saying, you know, there's this offer, we're making this available to you, and if you don't take it, you may lose your job anyway.
I mean, Trump's director of Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vogt, has said that traumatizing bureaucrats is part of the goal, that he wants them to feel targeted so that they're more likely to leave. Kirk, does what Andrea and Jeff are describing ring true to the people you've spoken with and the reporting you've done?
It does. And to zero in a little bit on what Andrea is saying, in the USDA, it's a massive federal agency. And underneath the USDA is the U.S. Forest Service, which is often dubbed the fire service. They're the lead agency for firefighting. And there's a lot of uncertainty about restructuring there. It's unclear exactly how many people were RIFT or reduction in force back in February. Officially, the agency is telling us 2,000 or so Forest Service employees. The union is telling us it's higher than that. And the Trump administration is maintaining that no wildland firefighting positions were cut. But that's not really the whole picture, because many people hold these red cards, which allow them to more or less drop their day job and respond to major wildland fires. And it is really not clear coming into the summer fire season how much these agencies are staffed and how much these crews are staffed.
How much are you seeing the backtracking that Andrea described of people getting fired and rehired or taking the buyout and then those positions being filled again?
Well, in New Mexico, I spoke with a wildlife biologist, Kayla, whose full name we aren't using because she fears retaliation. She is still employed by the agency, but in February initially lost her job, and then a court case put her back in, and she says it's just very much been an emotional roller coaster, not knowing what's going to happen next, and just a lot of work isn't getting done, she says.
And then it's hard to proceed with a lot of the things we're doing because a lot of funds are still frozen. So it's kind of, we're in limbo right now.
And I should say, Ari, this is Jeff, at the nuclear agency, there was a quick reversal without any court cases. They realized very quickly that they needed these workers, and it was pretty embarrassing. They had to rehire them almost as quickly as they fired them.
It's been nearly impossible to get a comprehensive view of how many people in the federal government have lost their jobs, in part because of all of the back and forth, the roller coaster that you're describing. But can you say broadly how all of this is likely to affect the services that Americans rely on from the government, whether it's mental health care for veterans or air traffic control?
Yeah, all right, I'll jump in here. This is Andrea again. You know, I think that what I'm hearing from workers is that Americans may not be thinking about, you know, the person checking to make sure the produce they're buying in the supermarket is, you know, free of disease. But these are services that Americans, you know, have come to rely on. And they, you know, describe a situation in which some of these services are going to be delayed or disrupted. I mean, you know, Secretary Rollins said that people in key positions, you know, were not being allowed to leave the government. I mean, people dispute that. But still, when you have, as Kirk mentioned, like a lot of support people leaving, you know, example I was given is, if there's a, you know, a technician who goes and responds when there's, you know, some kind of sickness seen on a farm, well, the person that books that person's travel, who makes sure they have everything they need to go do that job, that person may have left. And so there's just a delay in getting people out there and getting people to respond and provide the services that Americans in general have come to expect.
This is Kirk again. You know, the headlines are often about the big fires in the West, but remember, the West in particular is full of public lands and national parks. And I think it's going to become a little bit more clear in the weeks ahead as the summer season approaches. This will start hitting home and affecting everyday Americans and others when they visit national parks or national forests and see the work that hasn't been going on. The people who were cut from river permits, trail crews, hours at national park visitors centers. It's a big part of the economy, particularly in the West.
So further DOGE cuts are currently on hold since a judge in San Francisco pressed pause on the government restructuring. Still, the Trump administration has said DOGE is eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse of taxpayer dollars. Can you say to what extent that's true?
Yeah, Ari, I heard a lot of questions about this from people at the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, including from one person who took the deferred resignation offer. You know, on their very first day of administrative leave, their colleagues started calling them and saying, you know, your job is on this list of open positions that they're now trying to fill. And so this person was saying, you know, someone else is going to be paid to do my job while I'm also being paid full salary and benefits through the end of September. Where's the efficiency in that? And also, you know, this part of USDA and other agencies within the federal government are mostly fee-funded, meaning their salaries are paid for by fees for the government services, not through taxpayer dollars.
And of course, just a reminder that the federal workforce, the civilian federal workforce, is actually a very small percentage of the overall federal budget. You know, most of the money that goes out the door each year goes to defense, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. So how much you can save with all these cuts is questionable.
Jeff Brumfiel, Andrea Hsu, and Kirk Sigler are three of the NPR reporters who've been covering the reduction of the federal workforce across the United States. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
You're welcome, Ari.
If you heard there was buried treasure in your city, would you hunt for it? Well, that's what some people in San Francisco did yesterday after seeing cryptic clues on Reddit describing the whereabouts of a chest brimming with gleaming ingots, currency, and San Francisco artifacts. NPR's Chloe Veltman joined a group of prospectors on the trail.
Eamon McLaughlin and his friends stand in a parking lot overlooking the ruins of Sutro Baths, a historic swimming pool complex on the edge of the Pacific Ocean. He's going over the clues.
18 bold letters preserved in a clearing cite a dark room's view of brave surfers reeling.
The clues led a lot of people on Reddit to Sutro Baths. McLaughlin and his friends asked an AI model, Google Gemini, for an assist.
Plugged it in just to see what it spat out, but it just confirmed our theory.
This part of the city is in the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. Roberta Walker, who works at the Welcome Center there, says it's an odd place to look for buried treasure.
Because you can't dig around here in the national park. Suppose you can dig down at the beach, though.
McLaughlin's group did throw a shovel in their car, but after about an hour of poking around,
I'm really stumped.
They decide it's time to take it elsewhere. Next stop, Golden Gate Park.
Hey, good luck, guys.
Keep you updated on it.
They didn't find the treasure, but others did.
A big gold nugget.
That was in a bottle that was corked and had sand in it.
Gold francs.
Panama Pacific Exposition bronze coin.
This is Austin Terrio, TJ Lee, and Eric Bari describing what they found after just over an hour of searching.
Three collectible Barry Bonds baseball cards.
They went back and forth about the clues all day at work. They all have jobs in tech, but Bari says they knew better than to trust the puzzle-solving skills of AI.
They actually strengthen our take on Sutro not being the place to look.
Terrio says they relied on their knowledge of the city, their intuition, and their smarts to decipher the clues.
It's validating to be like, I know San Francisco well enough that we were able to find this first spot we checked.
They found the metal box containing roughly $10,000 worth of treasure buried under a bush near a hiking trail intersection, more than 5 miles away from Sutro Baths. Chloe Veltman, NPR News, San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Omaha, Nebraska has long been known as a blue dot in a red conservative state. But for over a decade, there's been a Republican mayor at the helm, the first woman to hold that position. Now, in what some are calling an upset, Nebraska's largest city has elected a Democrat, the city's first Black mayor-elect. Cassidy Arena from Nebraska Public Media reports.
It was an exciting moment for the small crowd gathered at John Ewing Jr.'s election party when the results showed the five-term county official had won about 56% of the vote to become the city's first elected Black mayor. The most excited person was Ewing himself.
I have prepared for this really all of my adult life with my public service, and I hope that would carry the day with the voters, that they would say, we know this guy. We've watched him grow up in our community as a leader, and I think that really made a difference with the voters.
Republican Jean Stothert had been hoping for a fourth term. She had served as Omaha's mayor since 2013 and was the first woman to hold the position. Although there are around 19,000 more Omaha voters registered as Democrats than Republicans, for many, her loss came as a surprise. Stothert gave her concession speech about an hour after polls closed.
Tonight, I am very proud, and I'm grateful, and I'm hopeful. I am hopeful that the momentum that we have created will continue.
The Nebraska Republican Party released a statement following the election results, saying the loss has prompted them to rethink how they reach voters. Randall Atkins is a professor of political science at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. He says considering this was an off year for elections, the 30% turnout was somewhat expected. What was less expected, perhaps, was how heated the campaigns became. Stothert ran anti-trans television ads, saying Ewing supported boys and girls bathrooms in sports, while Ewing's team sent out flyers criticizing Stothert, tying her campaign to President Trump's agenda. Despite the political tension, Adkins says the election results simply show how Democrats in Omaha have become much more active.
We see Democrats are really competitive in this district. So they're campaigning, they're collecting data, they're raising money. And while they've done that at the presidential level and the congressional level, there is a carryover effect for other races.
Mayor-elect John Ewing Jr. will start his term in June. Ewing says he plans to get to work right away. He says he'll focus on job creation, affordable housing, and expanding Omaha's urban core. For NPR News, I'm Cassidy Arena in Omaha, Nebraska.
In his new novel, The Emperor of Gladness, Ocean Vuong describes characters who work together in a Connecticut fast food restaurant as people bound by nothing but toil
in a tiny kitchen that was never truly a kitchen, paid just above minimum wage, their presence known to each other mostly through muscle memory, the shape of their bodies ingrained in the psyche from hours of periphery maneuvering through the narrow counters and back rooms of a fast food joint designed by a corporate architect, so that they would come to know the sound of each other's coughs and exhales better than those of their kin and loved ones.
Vuong worked in fast food, and The Emperor of Gladness is partly a love letter to these workers.
I think they are Americans who dream. You know, I think I'm more interested in Americans who dream than I am in the American dream. Because when you reframe that, you reframe the American dream as something around Americans who dream, you get to see them as individuals and you realize there is no monolith to this place that we live in. It's so large. Most of us don't even really know how other parts of us live. But when you look at people who work in a fast food restaurant, you realize that no matter how different their ideologies are, and there were vastly different ideologies where I worked, kinetic kinship degrades and corrodes those ideologies. Hmm. It's really hard to hate somebody when you need them to finish the shift with you, when you start to see them sweat in the third or fourth hour, and you see the sweat glistening on the locket that they have around their neck, how it opens to the picture of their grandmother who they love dearly. It made a big impact on me as a person to know that human relationships will always outpace ideological polemics.
You know, my grandfather made my mother work in a factory for a summer because he wanted her to have that experience, which to me always seemed a little cruel, and you're making me see it in a different light, that mm-hmm. there may have been a gift he gave her beyond the knowledge of hard, repetitive work that goes to what you're describing right now.
Yes, I think, you know, I can't speak for your grandfather, but I think you realize that everything you do has a price. It has a cost. Every action you take, you know, fast food workers, their humanity is often obfuscated. They are valued only for their hands, what they can do with their hands. But they are some of the most, I've seen some of the greatest problem solving and innovation in a fast food restaurant. Hmm. I've seen a chicken thigh taped to a freezer to keep it open. You know, like, and it's like, I'll never forget it. And it's like, that's a perfect way to solve that, because there was nothing else that would keep it open just enough so we can go in and out. And to me, they're survival artists.
You're reminding me to mention that this book also has a tremendous sense of humor. There are moments that made me laugh out loud in the midst of the beauty and the pain and the epic sweep of these individual lives. There are just absurd, hilarious sequences.
I think you realize that you have to laugh in order to not cry. And I think when you know that you're going into this little box of a restaurant and you're going to be with six or seven people for the next 8 hours, it's almost like a sonnet. You know, the sonnet has been accredited to being one of the most innovative forms of Anglophonic poetry, because of its restrictions. It demands, you can't veer too far, so you have to innovate inward. And that's what the shift was to me, is that I knew that I could not turn away from these people, regardless of how I feel about them. So I needed to build a relationship that would help us survive. And part of that is humor. You know, the immense amount of humor and the absurdity of living the modern life, and showcasing that freely, was how we got through some of those brutal, brutal shifts.
Ocean Vuong's new novel is The Emperor of Gladness. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ari. It's an honor.
And you can hear yesterday's conversation with Ocean Vuong, including what his mother, grandmother, and aunts taught him about the capacity for wonder, at npr.org.
This is NPR News.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case challenging the constitutional provision that guarantees citizenship to everyone born in the United States.
Citizenship under the 14th Amendment needs to apply in a way that is uniform across the country.
The dispute over birthright citizenship tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is testifying on Capitol Hill for the first time as health secretary.
He's faced questions about President Trump's cuts to public health agencies and research.
I could talk to you about scientific corruption all day long, about horror stories that we know have happened within NIH.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. As President Trump continues his three-nation Mideast trip, he got a warm welcome in Qatar today, where he landed in Doha to a military greeting and music. For the first time in 25 years, a U.S. president met with a Syrian leader in a striking moment. For a man who was once on a U.S. list of designated terrorists for his past links to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, Trump described him as a young, attractive guy with a very strong past, as we hear from NPR's Aya Boutraoui.
This meeting included Trump, the Saudi crown prince, and Turkey's President Erdogan on the phone with Ahmed al-Sharra, that's the new Syrian president, for about half an hour in Riyadh. Photos showed him shaking hands with Trump. This guy had a $10 million bounty on his head just months ago for ties with terror groups that the U.S. designates as. So now this militant leader, he's a statesman in a suit and says his government is ready to rebuild a relationship with the United States.
NPR's Aya Boutraoui. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy was in the hot seat on Capitol Hill this afternoon, where lawmakers raised concerns over failing infrastructure at Newark International Airport, one of the nation's busiest hubs. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports.
Lawmakers say outdated radar systems, delays, and safety concerns reflect a broader break in the country's aviation infrastructure. Testifying before a House committee, Secretary Sean Duffy said the administration is working urgently to address delays at Newark.
We're working at lightning speed and pace to get this resolved in Newark. Again, today the FAA is having a conversation about how all the airlines can come together to reduce the flights at Newark. So if you book your flight, you know it's going to fly.
The hearing comes amid a series of near misses and growing public frustration over the safety and reliability of the nation's air travel system.
This is NPR. The Max streaming service will get a new name this summer, HBO Max. The change actually resurrects the original name of the streaming service, as we hear from NPR TV critic Eric Deggans.
2 years ago, when Warner Brothers Discovery dropped the HBO from the name of its streaming service, some questioned the wisdom of discarding a brand name associated with groundbreaking TV hits like The Sopranos, Sex and the City, and Game of Thrones. The restoration of the HBO Max title, announced at an event for advertisers in New York, seems to acknowledge that idea, as executives said it signaled a focus on specifically unique, quality content. The name change could also signal a move towards separating some assets owned by Warner Brothers Discovery, like its cable channels, into an independent company. Warner Brothers Discovery did not provide a specific date for the name change. Eric Deggans, NPR News.
California is facing a $12 billion budget deficit, and Governor Gavin Newsom says broad economic uncertainty is partly to blame. The Democratic governor says ever-changing tariff policies from the Trump administration, coupled with a volatile stock market, will cause more major cuts to services and programs in the Golden State, including putting a freeze on enrollment in state-funded health care for migrants without legal status. That'll happen next year. On Wall Street, stocks finished mixed today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/iulab. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. spent today testifying on Capitol Hill, explaining President Trump's budget proposal for the Department of Health and Human Services for next year. NPR's Selena Simmons-Steffen watched many hours of hearings today, one in the House, one in the Senate, and is here to help us understand it all. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Selena, I know the topic was supposed to be the president's 2026 budget, and yet I understand many other issues came up. Tell us more.
Oh, yeah, lots of issues. So Kennedy's moves on autism and vaccines came up. So did the measles outbreak in West Texas and the 20,000 some staff that has been fired or taken buyouts from HHS. There were some fiery exchanges. And at the beginning of Kennedy's statement in the Senate hearing this afternoon, he was interrupted by protesters who were escorted out.
The budget I'm presenting today supports these goals and reflects.
The protesters were saying RFK kills people with AIDS.
Wow, that's remarkable. Okay, Selena, what did you learn from Kennedy today?
Well, one thing is that Kennedy said Elon Musk and his team developed the blueprint for those cuts, the 20,000 people who have left the agency. And then he implemented the plan with an ability to override things. He mentioned he prevented Head Start from being cut, for example. That's an early childcare program. Kennedy did seem a bit fuzzy on the specifics of what actually was cut and how many of those cuts have affected services. So many issues that lawmakers mentioned, like delays in payments to community groups and clinical trial issues, he said he had to look into things and get back to lawmakers. He did not have a lot of clarity about who was fired at HHS and why and what portion of those fired might be brought back. Here is an exchange Kennedy had with Senator Andy Kim of New Jersey. Kim said he had talked to a fire captain who worked at Ground Zero and was upset about HHS cutting the World Trade Center health program.
Why was the staff cut for this program? What are we to expect going forward?
I restored the staff to that program.
But why was it cut to start with?
It was part of the overall budget cuts.
Kennedy said the time it would have taken to prevent mistakes like this would have allowed inertia to set in. The agency would have remained too big and unable to help the American population get healthier, which he says is his big goal.
Okay, let me ask you this. The issue of vaccines was a huge issue during Kennedy's confirmation. How did that play out today?
Well, the chair of the Senate Help Committee, the Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, he did not make vaccines a big part of his questioning. I was watching for that. But another senator, Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, did, and it got contentious. Here is some of that exchange.
Are you actually still recommending people get the vaccine, or are you not?
Senator, if I advise you to swim in a lake that I knew there to be alligators in, wouldn't you want me to tell you there were alligators in it?
So are you recommending the measles vaccine or not?
What I've said and what I said...
It doesn't sound like you are, if that's...
Are you going to let me answer? Are you going to keep it?
Are you or are you not?
Kennedy was asked several times in the House hearing and in the Senate hearing about the measles vaccine in particular, and he did not clearly endorse it. He instead said that he didn't think people should be getting their medical advice from him.
Well, Selena, did it seem like lawmakers are going to push back on the direction that Kennedy is taking the department?
Kennedy got a lot of pushback from Democrats, and he got some tough questions from Republican lawmakers. And of course, they hold the majority in both the House and the Senate. Several Republicans seemed to really concerned about the plan to cut back on biomedical research. Lawmakers from Oklahoma and Maine, for instance, brought this up. That funding has been a huge economic driver in those communities. But the picture Kennedy kept painting is that NIH has been investing in the wrong places, not doing quality science. And in general, Kennedy seems like he's standing behind the huge sweeping changes to his agency.
NPR Selena Simmons-Steffen, thank you.
Thank you.
On the field, Pete Rose was a star.
From Shaw in the left center. There it is. Rose has eclipsed Cobb.
Rose amassed the most hits of any Major League Baseball player, a record that he still holds today. But Rose's legacy has been mired in controversy. He was banned from the MLB for life in 1989 for betting on games as a manager and player, essentially dashing any hopes of him making it into the Hall of Fame. Well, this week, bans on Rose and 16 others were lifted. In a surprise decision, MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred decided that deceased players should be removed from the league's ineligible list. Rose died last September. What is the impact of this decision, and what does it mean for Pete Rose's legacy? Keith O'Brien is the author of Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. He joins us again. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Great to be with you, Elsa.
Great to have you. Okay, so first, do you have a sense of what might have led the MLB to make this decision?
Well, I think first and most importantly, it was Pete Rose's death. You know, when I was reporting my book, I did get access to Rose for a while. And he told me then, way back in 2021, he predicted that when he died, he would be removed from baseball's ineligible list. And I believe Pete knew this because at times over the course of his life, he was his own worst enemy. He would self-sabotage again and again. The second thing is, his family, you know, applied for his reinstatement. And the third thing, not insignificant, is that President Trump began to call for a federal pardon of Pete Rose, which I think placed some pressure on Major League Baseball to do something. So yeah. I think all three of those things created the momentum for this significant sea change in Major League Baseball's policy.
Well, given the past conversations you personally had with Rose, what was your own reaction when you first heard this news that Rose is going to be eligible for the Hall of Fame?
I have learned to not be surprised about anything when it comes to the story of Pete Rose. Uh-huh. That said, Elsa, I was still stunned. It was a stunning development, a certainly historic development, and it has changed what has long been a hypothetical debate about Pete Rose and his legacy and the Hall of Fame into a real and raging debate about Pete Rose and his legacy and the Hall of Fame.
Do you feel that gambling has been seen as a special kind of sin in baseball, more than, say, taking steroids? And if so, if gambling is its own special sin, why is that?
In baseball, gambling has always been its own special sin. And it goes back to the 1920s. You know, after that 1919 scandal involving the Chicago White Sox, which conspired to throw games for money, there were a handful of other gambling scandals involving Major League stars in the 1920s. And so it did make it a special sin, even worse, say, than the use of performance-enhancing drugs. Now, that era gutted the hallowed records held by the all-time greats. It fundamentally changed the game, how players swung their bats. It fundamentally changed the statistics, made the games slower. I think you can make an argument that the steroid era did a far greater damage to the game than either scandal involving Pete Rose or the 1919 White Sox.
Keith O'Brien is the author of Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Thank you so much for coming on again, Keith.
Thank you for having me, Elsa.
This is NPR News. The World Food Prize is often called the Oscars of agriculture. This year it is going to a scientist in Brazil who discovered microbes in the soil that can make crops more productive. She was a part of a research team that helped turn Brazil into a food superpower rivaling the U.S. Dan Charles has the story.
Mariangela Ungria says she had a magical grandmother. They explored nature together, plants and soil.
And then one day it was holiday. She gave me one of her books to read. It was about the life of the microbiologists.
Ungria spent that whole night reading about scientists who study microscopic life, like bacteria and fungi, and she was hooked for life. She spent decades pursuing the idea that farmers could add microbes to the soil and it would help their crops produce bigger harvests. Her approach was unconventional. people were skeptical.
When I started my career, everybody was like, you're crazy, you'll never succeed in life, this will never be possible.
But her ideas panned out. She found microbes that were good at capturing nitrogen from the air and turning it into fertilizer for crops. Others released hormones that got plants to grow bigger roots so they could capture nutrients more efficiently.
She is a phenomenal scientist, a role model for many, many people, including myself.
Leo Bortolan is a soil scientist from Brazil who's now on the faculty at North Dakota State University. He says thanks to Ungria's work, most seeds of major crops in Brazil, like soybeans or corn, now are coated with these microbes before planting. That lets farmers get by with less chemical fertilizer. Ungria spent her whole career, 40-plus years, within an organization that helped transform Brazilian agriculture, the Brazilian Agricultural Research Corporation, or Embrapa. Ryan Nearing at the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington, D.C., says it has an almost mythic status.
Embrapa is this heroic institution in Brazil that conquered the wild lands of the interior, made them productive.
This was not the Amazon. It was a vast region of grasslands with scattered trees. The soil there was acidic. People thought it was useless for agriculture. But Embrapa scientists showed farmers how to add lime and other materials to the soil and make it fertile. And Mariangela Ungria says the results have been incredible. 50 or so years ago, Brazil had to import its food.
And today, look, we are the first exporter of soybean, sugar, coffee, beef, chicken.
But she'd also like to see some changes in Brazilian farming. It's been dominated by men and a kind of masculine attitude, she says, always claiming more land, competing.
I want to produce. I want to be the winner of production. You know, I want to go to new frontiers and so on.
Ungria says she'd like to see more women involved in farming and a different style of agriculture, caring for the land you already have rather than clearing more forests, focusing not just on the size of the harvest but how nutritious it is. She'll formally accept her award later this year. It's $500,000. She says she'll use that money to set up a new award for women who are doing work similar to hers. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Early into his Middle East trip this week, President Trump made a major announcement.
I will be ordering the cessation of sanctions against Syria in order to give them a chance at greatness.
Those sanctions have been in place for decades. In some parts of Syria, people took to the streets to celebrate this news. Moaz Mustafa is the executive director of the Syrian Emergency Task Force. He and his family fled Syria in the 1990s, and his organization now runs humanitarian programs there. He joins me in studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to start by asking you for your reaction to that announcement that President Trump made.
Incredible. I think it's a historic moment. And I think a lot of people don't realize how important and historic this moment is. This isn't just a fresh start for Syria. This is actually a real chance at stability and peace in the Middle East more broadly, because Syria is so geopolitically important in the region that this goes well beyond its borders.
On your social media account, you posted that your group, the Syrian Emergency Task Force, played a role in normalizing ties between Syria and the United States, which includes meeting with Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Shara. Can you tell us about that meeting?
Sure. I was actually a delegation. We were there about a week and a half ago or so, and we brought this American delegation with us. It included Syrian American Jews wanting to rebuild the oldest synagogue in the world destroyed by the Assad regime. It included an American businessman as well, interested in keeping China out of Syria and wanting U.S. companies to work in Syria in the future. And we were supposed to meet with the Syrian president for 15 minutes. The meeting went over 3.5 hours.
Wow.
And we were all, I think, equally excited and impressed. We were excited about the fact that all of Syria and what this new leader was saying Syria's national interests are were exactly what American interests are in the region, like getting rid of ISIS, Iran, Russia, etc. And number two, kind of very happy to see that there's this kind of right leader at the right time, despite his checkered past, by the way, but the right leader at the right time to help Syria in this transitional period. And he wanted a partnership with the United States. He wanted and saw in President Trump hope for peace and stability in Syria.
The last time we spoke with you, back in December, you were literally heading to catch a flight to Syria. As I understand, it was your first time going back in many, many years and since the fall of the Assad regime. Can you just tell us, what was it like to go back there?
So that was my first time going back to Damascus since like 2009. And because Damascus was always under the control of Assad, so I could go to liberated areas, but never Damascus. When I arrived there, it was like a dream. I mean, I did not know sometimes if that day would ever come, that Syria would be free of this dictator that has ruled alongside and before him his father for over 50 years. And backed by the Russian Air Force, backed by Iranian ground troops and all of these things. And to see Damascus free, to be able to smell the jasmine in the old city that is just beautiful, to see the people, even those that some of which may have been loyal to Assad, feel the freedom of being able to speak their minds regardless of who is in power. And to physically be able to tear down pictures of Bashar al-Assad on every wall that I saw, it was amazing to see good triumph over evil for once.
Wow. Now, your organization runs a number of humanitarian programs there in Syria. So I just wonder, in practical terms, what does the lifting of these sanctions mean for those efforts? Does it change the way that you're able to do your work?
It makes life much easier. So look, for example, we're an American org based in Arkansas and D.C. And just because Syria is in our name, bank transactions out of overcompliance get like stopped, you know, or sending cash, sending money to the teachers teaching orphans and displaced children or the women's high school or to the besieged people at the time of Rukban camp was really tough. We had to literally physically take cash and bring it over there to be able to help them. This, amongst many other things, will change. And most importantly, Syria will be able to receive huge reconstruction investment and humanitarian aid way beyond what our little organization does. But it helps us, and I think it helps Syria in a much bigger way.
Now, before we let you go, I'd just love to hear a bit about what you're hearing from people there in Syria now. What are they telling you about what they want and what they need?
Well, first of all, they're very grateful. They're grateful that all of the sacrifices of 1 million martyrs, 14 million displaced, you know, just all of the struggle was not in vain. And they're grateful to the United States for lifting these sanctions. They're grateful to President Trump to do so. I know that people stayed out celebrating all night the day that President Trump made that announcement. And now they're hoping for their country to become what the revolution wanted it to be in the beginning, which is a democracy. And I think for me, I think Syria is the closest Arab country to a true democracy out there, because of what the Syrian people have been able to do. And I think the United States, not just as a government, but as a people, schools, universities, faith groups, Syria is a place that can be a democracy, that can stabilize this region that's been plagued by war. I think it's all of our obligation to help them reach that goal.
Moaz Mustafa is the executive director of the Syrian Emergency Task Force. Thank you for coming back and talking to us.
Thanks for having me again.
All right, it's time for the latest installment in our series, Here to Help, that looks at service and community in America. Today, we go to Silver Spring, Maryland, where a group of volunteers are working to help new parents with a basic need, diapers.
So we are at the warehouse for the Greater DC Diaper Bank, and I am leading a volunteer session of people from our community who have volunteered to help bundle diapers to be distributed throughout the community for families who are in need of diapers. I'm Colleen Texera Moffitt, and I'm a warehouse warrior with the Greater DC Diaper Bank. We are unpackaging the diapers and putting them into the sets of 25 so that they can be distributed to our community partners and then to the families who need them. It's one of my favorite volunteer activities I've ever done, in part because it's just, like, at the end of it, what we'll do is we will count up all of the diapers that we have and we will tally up, like, how many diapers that is. And it's just, like, the end of it, you have just, like, a nice sense of accomplishment. Like, we did 2,000 diapers, and it's always, like, a nice cathartic big number. I mean, it's such an unbelievably basic need, and if families have the things that they need, it can help them feel less stressed and provide a little bit more stability into their day-to-day lives. It's such a fundamental basic need. I can't imagine how it must feel to not have those needs on a day-to-day basis met. And then, I mean, also, like, the other reason I personally come is that when things feel a little chaotic and out of control globally in my own life, like, it, I always feel good when I've left, like, 100% of the time.
You're going to deliver those? Okay, make sure they get tallied, okay?
One of the things that's great about this particular volunteer opportunity is, like, it's so tangible. It's also very physical, so, like, you're moving around. You can understand it. You're with other people who care, who want to help. And so there's that kind of, like, sense of community. And it's also just very, I don't know, like, it's not controversial, right? Like, we're helping babies. Like, what could be simpler than that? As you can see, I'm on an endorphin high.
And here's where we ask for your help. Tell us a story of volunteer service from your own life or suggest someone for us to interview. Go to npr.org and search Here to Help.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Linda Moodbell Learning Center's one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead, online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. Fisherinvestments.com, investing in security.